Whenever I visit France, I always see lots of top bottles for sale, but when I get back home, those same bottles can be much harder to find, if not impossible. That's why I use idealwine.com. At idealwine.com, I can buy wines directly from France for delivery directly to my home. They have new auctions every week, and the fixed price selection is equally awesome. Clos Vougeard, Chateau Reyes, and Ulysse Collan, as well as many more greats from all over France, are regularly available on the website. Best of all, it is simple and hassle-free to buy them. Ideal Wine handles all the customs and logistics hurdles for you and for me. Wines are ordered with a couple of clicks, and then they arrive. It is simple. Check out idealwine.com for more information. That's IDEALWINE.com to find what you'd like to be drinking.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
The grapes in Barolo have a foggy history, both literally and figuratively. The hints of winemaking in this region are as early as 1266, when the word Nebbiolo appears on record, etymologically linked to a root word meaning fog. And it's certain that Nebbiolo was popular in the Langhe at least by the 1430s, and probably much earlier. In 1431, Nebbiolo was so important that a statute noted that cutting down a Nebbiolo vine would dock you a high monetary fine. In Barolo, the soil is layers of marine sediments that present today as chalk, clay, and sandstone. To generalize, you'll find mostly sandstone in the Serralunga Valley in the south and east, and more clay in Lamora to the northwest. In Serralunga d'Alba, you'll find the oldest soil formations, and coincidentally, the wines from this subregion tend to better handle more age. The wines from the younger soils tend to drink better younger. Though, of course, there are always plenty of exceptions. Some of the early references to Nebbiolo are from Thomas Jefferson. When he first tried Nebbiolo, he described it as about as sweet as the silky Madeira, as astringent on the palate as Bordeaux, and as brisk as Champagne. It is a pleasing wine. And there's another famous Jefferson Nebbiolo quote from a letter that is often paraphrased. Most references to this quote indicate that Nebbiolo in Jefferson's time was sparkling. But if you go back to the original quote, it seems that Thomas Jefferson is actually politely complaining to a friend who had brokered the sale. As I interpret the quote, his complaint is that one of the bottles was re-fermenting. He wrote,
"The single bottle of the 200 had probably been bottled too new. It had nothing of the Nebbiolo character, but its sparkling. It had the excessive sweetness of new wine. I mention this to you because I know you were so kind as to pass on these parcels to me."
Thus, some references to Jefferson's sparkling Nebbiolo may be misinterpretations of this quote. But in the 1800s, there definitely may have been a little sweetness to the wines in general. Medals given to Barolos in the 1873 Global Exhibition indicated both a Barolo and a Barolo Secco, so a movement toward dry winemaking was underway by this time. Wine fraud was also underway. In the mid-1800s, Barolo wines were being copied, and lesser wines were sold under the prestigious name. Local government initiatives to secure the prestige of the name began to foment. Vineyards were formatted differently in the 1800s and very early 1900s. They were usually interplanted with crops. Vine rows were spaced far apart, and the harvests of the various crops followed a schedule. First, you'd harvest the wheat between the vines, then you'd do any necessary grape treatments, and then you'd harvest the grapes for the wine. Some older growers today who remember the old polyagricultural layouts recall that some of the vines suffer today because the soil gets compacted now that the wheat isn't harvested and tilled regularly between the vine rows. Like so many regions, in the 1930s, phylloxera devastated the area. It had hit before, but the 30s outbreak was the catalyst for major change in grafting. As vineyards died, replanting vineyards on American rootstock and switching over to monocultural vineyards took place. Then in the 1930s, winemaking became difficult, but for political reasons. German soldiers would pass through and pillage wine. Maria Chiavesa describes her encounter with German soldiers in the book A Wine Atlas of the Lange. They started drinking the wine, and then, drunk and angry, they began to loose off gunfire everywhere. As they raged through the town, they found the wine in the cellar. They arrived in the courtyard with their lorries and started loading up as much wine as they could. I could see them from the window of my room, and I thought to myself, I can't just stand here. What would I say to my husband? That I watched and did nothing? So I went out in slippers to speak to the captain, who had an interpreter with him. I told him it was my wine, not the partisans. My intervention was totally fruitless. And since they couldn't carry all the wine away, they came back the following Monday. They came up to our cellar, and I tried to humor them, but they wanted to clean out the cellar where our wine was. And in fact, they carried off every single bottle. It took decades to rebuild after World War II. But from the 1960s through the present, Barolo has been an incredibly interesting wine region to keep an eye on. It's a place where winemaking techniques are scrutinized more so than other wine regions, and consumers attempt to group the different Barolos into very general styles. It's a region where, despite our constant attempts to pigeonhole these wines, they seem to have an immortality to them. Barolo is an interesting area, too, in the context of climate change. There are a few other regions that exist at the limit of where wine can be grown. And in marginal climates, specifically cold, wet, or foggy marginal climates in Europe, and with the warmer temperatures in the last 12 years or so, all of these usually difficult climates, primarily Champagne, the Moselle, and Barolo, have had a string of really nice vintages. Will warmer temperatures continue to help vintages in the future? Or will it change the ultimate character of the Barolo we know today? Will it give a boost to some of the other popular grapes grown in the area? Keep listening to hear more Barolo insights.
It's not enough to make great wine. You also have to reach the consumer that appreciates that wine. And that's where Offset is an incredible asset. Offset is an independent brand design and commerce technology company that connects with wineries on a human level to help them connect with consumers on a human level. Offset is based in wine country and staffed by creative strategists and technologists who are superb at helping create and evolve wine brands through visual identity and package design, developing the look, feel, and tone of your web content, as well as building beautiful and effective websites powered by their proprietary e-commerce platform, Offset Commerce. That's why leaders like Frog's Leap, Grace Family Vineyards, and Rain Winery already rely on Offset. Reach out to the brilliant team at Offset at offsetpartners.com. That's OFFSET partners with an S.com. Offset is focused on the wine industry and can embrace the nuanced needs of your wine brand. Luca Corrado Vietti of Vietti in Castiglione Folletto. Hello, sir. How are you?
Ciao. Very well. Thank you.
Very nice to have you here.
Me too. I'm very excited. A little bit excited. Happy and excited.
Well, you look good. So your cellar, part of it actually dates back to the 1600s.
The cellar is all under this huge village of Castiglione Folletto that is 500 people, 20 dogs and 30 cats. And
that's the village.
This is the village. We know all each other.
That's not just you.
No. I have sometimes more cat, sometimes more dog. Depends. No, it is very nice because the people when they arrive, in my yard, from the gate, they never expect. Let's say it's more similar to a Burgundian style winery because there are all these tunnel, these layer, many steps. Years ago, I thought that it was a limit because many level, many stairs was a problem. Then he helped me a lot because I can work more as a gravity, and but more important, I can eat more because I do a lot of step during the day. No,
it's important with the pasta. So good.
See, too much wine, too many wine dinner, and I love too much food, unfortunately, or fortunately. No, the first part of the winery was built by my family between the 16 1700. But honestly, we don't know the exact period because it was so long, long, long time ago. And we based our founding when we founded the first label of the family, that is 1873. Because as you know, in Italy, also in France, I think the fashion of selling the wine by bottle only started in the second part of the 1800. Before, the winery used to sell the wine by barrel to family or to tavern, and the people they use to bottle and their own. So this is the reason why, or probably because the generation before mine, they had a lot of fun and they drank all the good wine before. Who knows?
But you go deep into a cellar like that. I mean, it must seem like a different time.
It's incredible because... But working in all this tunnel, all this layer, you sometimes really you feel the history breathing from the wall, you know. Plus, this was one of the cellar that during the French occupation, we say invasion, they say occupation during the, anyway, different point of view. The General Segur was, there was the general of the French army. He was making the wine for the French army here. So Napoleone was in Cherasco. And Castiglione Falletto and Serra Lunga, they were two military based. And General Segur, that was the owner of Chateau Canon Segur, Chateau Felan Segur, and also Chateau Lafitte. We still have the bottling machine, some big bottle, the Napoleon bottle. It's funny. So, yes, there is the wall brief, a little bit of history.
The estate, the holdings, have gone through different changes over time. They were big, and then they got small, and they got big again. I mean, what was the history there?
Family became... winery, as we know, as we consider a winery, only in the second part of the 1800, probably when we founded this first label, because before the family was making wine, but then he had field, cows, many other activity. Only in this period, he became exclusively winery. The main business, the main income of the family was the wine. Probably also because it was a period when in the family, from one side of the family, there was two brothers. My great-grandfather and his oldest brother. And the oldest brother, as the typical Italian family, was in charge. He was the one that has to continue the family business. Then the second one in Italy, if the family can, maybe could study. But the third one always must to be a priest. This is the reason why there are a lot of priests. No, I'm the third one, but thanks God I have two older sisters. So, and then I'm too far away to be a priest. So it was no work for him and for his family. He became an engineer at the University of Torino. And he left, as many Italians, to look for fortune. And he ends up in Boston, in Massachusetts. And he lived there for 35 years. My grandmother, she was born in Quincy, Massachusetts. See, it's a very funny story. Incredible. And then during the First World War, the end of the First War, the brother that was in Italy, that he was not married, he didn't have the kids, died during the war. So all the family from America came back to Italy. So it's very, very strange, the life, you know. Who knows if we've been lucky or not, you know. But anyway, it was when my great-grandfather came back to the family, he did so many crazy things that today are the base, the fundamenta, the roots of our wine. He replanted Barbera Scarrone Vigna Vecchia in 1918. Because when he left Italy, it was very funny. Left Italy, Barbera was very popular. It was the real wine because the noble people, they were drinking Barolo, and the real people, they were drinking Barbera. Also because Barbera was the real wine for the food, and till today, for me, the best wine to do with food pairing. And when he came back, his brother used already all the good vineyards of Barbera planted in the Barolo region to make more Barolo, for sure, for economically reason. And when he came back, he said, on the terrace, you remember terrace of the winery? And he said, wow, porca miseria, there is no more good Barbera. So he planted 2 acres that we always kept as a respect. So this was one. Or another funny thing was that when he came back, this was my grandmother who told me this story, because for sure I never met him. And unfortunately, I also never met my grandfather. When he came back, he really had in his mind to do from Vietti something special. And he was a farmer, because he was a farmer, but he was an engineer. He traveled to America. He had incredible experience, you know. Actually, was probably one of the only Italian that went to America, and he came back with less money than what he had before. Anyway, so without too much fortune, but he had a very open mind. And he understood that if he wants to do something special from the winery, he had to source the grape from the best spot, the best vineyard. And he said he was calling this the good vineyard, the vineyard that today we call Grand Cru in our region. This was a crazy thing, because in the old time, if I take a winery old as my family, as a Rinaldi or Mascarello in Barolo, they make all their beautiful wine. They come from Barolo village for logistical reason, because in the old time there were no tractor and all the work they were done with cow and horses. So you want to have the vineyard there close, because it was easier to work. Or Marcarini, La Morra, Brunate, La Serra, or the Conterno family in Monforte. So this was the way how the winery tried to have their vineyard. And so he was going from Castiglione to Serra Lunga to Monforte, because he decided, instead to have one piece of land altogether, where maybe you have a good corner and less good part, to cherry pick, you know, to cherry pick the best spot all around the Barolo region, trying to do something different. And in my region, we give a nickname to the people. And his nickname, funny, this maybe will be very funny for you, they call him the crazy Americano, because the people didn't understand why this stupid guy was going with his horses and cows, wasting all this time going around. Thanks to him, today we have a collection of crew that is very important. We lost during some period, we get back in Italy, in Europe, in France, in all the Europe. Not many people, sometimes when you drink wine, remember that we had two world wars. And it was dramatic. First World War, in my village, they lost basically one generation, was gone. You know, from people from 16 to 25 was almost disappeared, dead, died on in the war. So big drama, you can imagine. You know, the reason why my family had to come back from America to here. And then during the Second World War was another huge moment, terrible moment. And really was very bad for my family, because during the second part, during the occupation, the German occupation, when Republican time in Italy, let's say, when, let's say, the Italian, they were no more good friends with the German after. So there were a lot of partisans, I think what you say, fighters, they tried to make our land free from the occupation of the German, you know, and all was related too. You can imagine all the drama of everything. Actually, Alba was a village that was able to get free before that the Allied arrived. They are called the Republic of the 44 Days, because for 44 days, Alba was free by the himself, by the partisan. They fight against the fascists and the German. They were there. But then the drama came back, because after 44 days, La Quarta Armata, Fourth Army of Germany, came and they... I don't know if many people, they know what means decimazione. Decimazione is a Roman word that means one every ten. And they killed in all the village one every ten. So this is the reason why for long... An example to Bartolo Mascarello, I remember for many, many years, he didn't want to sell his wine to the German, because he was living that time. And, you know, it was a really terrible moment. For sure, the German today do not have anything to to share with this one was a war. And for the drama for my family, beside this, absolutely, but nobody died, fortunately. But there was a dark side in the family because they were two brother and sister. Mario, my grandfather, he was supporting the partisan. He was a partisan himself. He was helping the people, hiding from the Germans and so on. And his sister, unfortunately, he had the bad idea to marry in Torino one of the top fascists. So it was really one of the highest. And you can imagine in a family, the two things, they couldn't go together, you know. Like I said, it was like a vinegar and oil, you know, the opposite.
Not a lot of good Easter dinners together.
No. No, not very much. I don't think so. They never get together. Was really. And so when his husband of his sister, his brother-in-law, they reported to him that his brother-in-law was doing this. Was, you know, he came to the winery and he said to my grandfather, you know, for respect of your sister, I'm not going to kill you. This also was always the story that my grandmother told to me. And I remember she was always crying at the end of the story because you can imagine family drama. And he said, you know, I'm not going to kill you because you are I give you a few months to sell all your property. If you do not sell all your land, and you can imagine for a farmer to be forced to sell your land is the worst thing that can happen. If you don't sell everything, I will come here in a few months. I don't remember what he said, 6 months, 8 months, or 2 months. I will steal everything, and I will... my grandmother told me that, you know, they rushed, they sold everything. Some part they were bought by some... their winery, the biggest part was sold to the church. The church is always good when they had to make a very good deal. And my grandmother, she was saying that with the money that they sold everything, all the land, not the winery, they were only able to buy 2 cows. Incredible. Minchia was to start again from scratch. But I think the goal of our family, in all our generation, was trying to buy back all the vineyard that we've been forced to sell. In Italy, Piemontese people are considered very stubborn people, you know, very testoni, you know, testardi, very determinated. And I think we could consider ourselves good Piemontesi, because little by little, in all the generation, he did a lot. He bought back a lot of vineyard. Many good other family in the village, in the region, they also been partisan. They really, you know, they resold at the same price. The one to the church was much more difficult because for sure my grandfather was a little bit more on the left side of the church. That was not easy. So we almost got all the vineyard, almost, not all, but we was some secret that made us strong, determined, and proud, you know. This. I always tell this story to my kids because I think I never lived, thanks God, and I hope I will never leave a war, I hope also for them, but these tell how the human beings and the family, when something happened, must to be strong and determined.
Is that why when your kids go to church, they start yelling at the priest? Like, you have our vineyard. This wine is from our vineyard.
it's Italy is like this. You know, there is the good and the bad. There are the power of the church is very important. Absolutely. You know, then depends. That was probably... I don't know, that specific priest that he was like this, I don't know.
You've forgiven him.
He's okay. Now we are happy. We have almost everything back, even more crew that we didn't have before. So he's, but You know, I always have a goosebump thinking about that because I always have in front of me every time the face of my Nonna Pierina, my grandmother, that lived the drama and it was unbelievable, you know, to listen the story from her mouth.
What else did she tell you about the old days?
I loved her because also we are farmer and my family was a farmer. My father and my mother, they never had too much time to dedicate to me, you know, because also I was the third kid, you know, so they were all two older sisters older than me. And my grandmother, basically, she raised me, you know, she was my first mother or second mother, not because my parents didn't want, but because they had to work in the vineyard, traveling, making the wine. And she was fantastic. I think one of the stories that I like very much related to the wine was that in the early 90s, when I started and to help my family to do some traveling or promotion after working in the vineyard, I remember I was coming home always very sad because we have to put ourselves in that moment. In that moment, there was a lot of big contrast between more traditional producer and more modern producer. I think you know, many of you probably saw the movie also, Barolo Boys. It was the moment where you know, a lot of very, very good growers, that now they make fantastic wine, they used to sell the grape to big winery, like Fontana Fredda or Marchesi di Barolo, that was called at the time differently, Pio Cesare, and so big estate. And they realized, say, wow, we have this great vineyard, why we don't make some wine? And they understood that, you know, if they wanted to become famous, they had to work better in the vineyard. And this was great electricity for the region because it gave a lot of energy to the region. Also, some traditional winery, honestly, like my family or Rinaldi or Mascarello, they had more competition, you know, so they had to work better in the vineyard. But, you know, their philosophy was a little bit more to make more modern style Barolo, you know, more darker Barolo, more fruity, more drinkable, younger, more oaky. And it was not easy time because it was a huge, huge contrast in this moment against. And honestly, it was a moment of my life that I still have something always on my stomach, he turned me, because it was not always a very polite moment, you know. And it was really, I remember one time one producer that he made an interview to Decanter, I think so, and he said that making a traditional wine is an excuse to make wine that stink. And you can imagine when I was younger in the family and my father for me was an hero, as was a hero in the winemaking Mascarello, Rinaldi, and listen, this story make you not feel comfortable, you know. And so it was really big conflict. But I was proud, you know, to do of what my family did for many generations. And going around to the world presenting wine, for sure that was a style that I still love some very modern Barolo, because there are some great producers of Barolo, they make fantastic wine. But was different than what we were making, much more darker in color, much more easy. Our wine was lighter in color, tannic, difficult at the beginning. And so many times when I was pouring the wine to sommelier or wine store, why, you know, why this is so light? Why so? And I received so many door on my nose, you know. We forgot this, because but this was like this. And so, cats, I was going home, sad, not too many sales. I remember it was a moment here in New York, we were working with Lauber, and Lauber was representing us and Monfortino, Roberto Conterno. And they were doing close out of Monfortino, I remember. And they were... Or Bartolo Mascarella, I remember close out in California that I had a friend that he bought all what was available. You know, can imagine a close out right now on this wine. It's crazy. But it was like this because people didn't buy. Going home, my grandmother, when I sit on the sofa, my grandmother arrives and says, Luca, what's going on? Why you are not happy? So tell the story, you know. And she said to me one thing that I thought was fantastic. And I didn't immediately understood because, you know, you take sometimes this word of these older people like, okay. You know. She said to me, Luca, don't worry. Relax. You do not have to follow the fashion. Fashion means 5 seconds. At 6, you are old. Do what you are able to do with respect of the history, your vineyard, your work, and don't worry. And then thinking and thinking, you know, she was right. You know, anyway, when you make a wine that you pretend that age longer than you, or you want that age longer than you, as a Barolo, as great Burgundy, as the great wine of the world, you know, I think looking the small window of the today is an error. So if you trust that your vineyard must be a modern style Barolo, do it. Because you need to trust it. If you trust that your vineyard or your interpretation of your terroir must be terroir, you must do it. Not just going around from one side to the other like a banderole, because that could be dangerous. Honestly, for me, when I was that moment, I was also very young. And then, you know, when you have a lot of energy, you think that you are able to change the world, you know, and then you do not, you understand that your world then is your vineyard, and then you have to do what you are able to do. And then for sure, in frame time, I learn every day from every vintages, you know. Ravera, that was a wine that I made in the 2000, and then when I went through 10 years of experiment, 10 years is a lot of time. In the wine industry, is nothing in the vineyard. In other business, they build a fortune in 10 years, you know. But, you know, we have one shot a year, one harvest a year. So you try and you experiment, and you need to be sure of what you do.
So your dad was Alfredo Corrado?
My father, yes, Alfredo.
And what was he like?
He was a very, very severe person, you know, very, you know, like a really old, was not very old, but was a farmer with big hands, big man, probably because I was little, I was looking him as big, you know, but he was a person that for me was I always thought that he was able to move a mountain from his power, his energy. And he had huge love of wine. I think, honestly, I think if you want to make wine, if you want to be a winemaker, you need to love wine before to make it, because if not, you don't do anything. And he married my mother. The story was was funny because he was a winemaker. He was an oenologist in Alba, but he was making in Canelli, he was making sparkling wine at the time, because people should remember that Canelli at the time was one of the largest wine region, and they were making the biggest production of Metodo Classico, much, much more than Franciacorta. Then unfortunately everything destroyed because disappeared, you know, probably became too industrialized, you know. So my father was always saying, you know, that the family of my mother, she was looking for a winemaker, but they couldn't afford to pay, so my mother married him. But, you know, he worked for a few years in Canelli. He worked even in a winery of very dear friends, Coppo, that they produce Barbera. They worked even there in the old time. Then when my grandfather passed away in a very, very early in 61, in the spring of 61, I think so, my father had to come to the winery, really 100%.
Immediately.
Immediately.
To come.
And, you know, to follow the business, you know.
So that seems like a big change.
See. And also because, you know, again, we are very proud and we are very egocentric sometimes also. The farmer, the winemaker, the winemaker is a big word, but we own a winery and we think that we are the number one. So it's difficult to let other people doing something in your garden, you know. And I think for my father and my grandfather, it was like this also. So when he passed away, he arrived there and he immediately put his energy and his philosophy. Unbelievable, you know. So, an example, 61, my father, you know, this is always the story, the first, the second, the third, I don't know, but let's say one of the first, at least from what we know, one of the first label person to bottle a single vineyard cru, Barolo, because the tradition in the old time was not to make a single vineyard cru vinification. Today, the map of Barolo is so colorful with all these beautiful 152 appellation, but in the old time, the top Barolo was like still today Bartolo Mascarello that used to blend the vineyard. The blend of the best vineyard was the top Barolo. The blend of the other vineyard was the regular Barolo. And, you know, to take the best from different personality of vineyard. So my father, that he loved Burgundy and understood anyway the potentiality of the single vineyard cru vinification, in 61 did the first vinification of Barolo Rocche. It was the same year that Beppe Colla in Prunotto, Prunotto now is owned by Antinori, but before was the family Colla, that made the Bussia. So it was last year, was very emotional for us because with the 2011 was the 50th anniversary for this wine. And we are very close to my father for thanks to this.
So I know that you weren't around at the time, but did your family tell you what the reception was to the Rocche when it was released?
We spoke a lot with my mother with regarding this, and my mother said that was not very well welcome. No, actually, she had a lot of resistance, mainly from the people in the village, mainly from the other wineries. My mother always tell the story that there was this very director of this cooperative that was also the mayor of the village of Castiglione Falletto, that he, one time he went to the house and he said, no, you cannot do this. You are changing the tradition. Why you wanted to do this? So was not very well welcome. I think probably the first one that really welcome was Veronelli, that was one of the most important person in the wine industry, that not many people always give the importance to him, but he was amazing. He loved it, and he encouraged my father, and my father, so little by little, started. He did also first Barbaresco, then little by little other vineyards. But, you know, it was really because, you know, he loved the wine, and he always saw as Burgundy as the point of arriving of everything. And so he thought that was possible to do the same.
So why do you think he chose Rocche to do it?
I'm not supposed to say this because he's is always a piece of heart in our heart for Rocche vineyard. And my father was always saying that Rocche was his vineyard, his wine, probably because it was also the first one that he made as a single vineyard crew. For sure, because it's a fantastic vineyard, because the quality that vineyard released is incredible. Also because it's the most challenging. It's the most challenging to work vineyard because it's one of the more steep vineyards. Many work you cannot do with a tractor. You have to do all by hand. In the springtime, when it rains, you cannot go with a tractor to spray the copper sulfate. You need to go, you know, on your shoulder. And last year we went on our shoulder there with the machine to spray the copper sulfate. It's a vineyard that in the summertime, if you forgot the something at the bottom of the vineyard and you arrive at the top, you say, okay, I don't go there or back. I leave there, I go maybe tomorrow.
That's how you lost that car that one time, right? You left it at the bottom. It's only a Fiat.
Let's leave there.
If it was a Lamborghini, I'd go back, but it's a Lancia. It's fine.
No, so very difficult to work, very difficult to interpret, also during the fermentation. Because Brunate, an example that I like and I love the elegance of
which
Brunate.
Which also make.
It's fantastic, you know. And from the beginning, you know that it's going to be good wine. At the beginning, when you crush the grape, you already know. Rocche is so reserved, so difficult. The tannin, they always takes time to get together. You never know when it's time to press the wine because the tannin, they always go up and down. But when everything get together, for me, it's like a masterpiece. You know, it's a fantastic. It's the one that gives you really more satisfaction to do.
Do you find that Roque shows the vintage more than some of the other crews?
Si. You know, Brunate being the most elegant, the most beauty, is also the one that the tannin are more ripe sooner, is always very sexy. It's the most sexy. It's like a woman with a big breast, you know, Brunate for me. Lazzarito is always a kind of block because Serra Lunga always mentioned the crew that I make. Then, you know, there are so many other that everybody has his own experience. Lazzarito is, for me, is like the most South Côte d'Iron wine. Always this spiciness, this black pepper, but always a very tannic and rich, like all the Serra Lunga wine, if you think about. Roque also, he doesn't have one of the best exposure because he's really go from southeast some part to east. And so really is where needs really the best condition. And also the tannin, they need to ripe very well there because it need to be a good season to make the tannin ripe very well. And so he's probably, yes, he's the one that sign more the vintages.
So your father was also known as an innovator in the winery. He did things.
In vinification, absolutely, because he was one of the first to introduce stainless steel in the...
For fermenting.
For fermenting. One thing very interesting is this, that the original pièce of fermentation in our region was not the Bordeaux style tonneau. The original piece of fermentation, and we had, and I was helping my father, was like the botti, the cask. And this botti, they had in the top a door, like the one that normally you see on the front, in wood. In the top, you remove, you put the grape inside, and you were doing the punch down, and then you the remontaggi, the pumping over, and everything. And then also, the botti was the right shape to make the steccatura, the submerge the cup, because it's not flat, but it's you know, oval or round, so the profile go down. So they used to put stick inside, stecke,
wooden piece of wood,
wooden
yeah.
stake,
hold down
to
the cap.
Hold down the cap and submerge the cap. And then after the fermentation, today we have the luxury, every winery to have the fermenting room, the barrel room. But in the old time, when they didn't have money to pay the electricity and they had to count every single penny, because today we live in a luxury moment of winemaking, but the time was not like this.
You chose the right time, I guess.
See, I don't know, so maybe the next generation, who knows? I don't know. They reuse for the aging. You know, they close upstairs and they put again the wine and they aged the wine. Then arrived the tonneau after, but this was already looks to have because the people, they use only the tonneau for fermentation. The aging was always the botti. And also, as you know, it's not very easy to steccare, you know, to do submerge the cup in a tonneau that is wide and large. They use a different system that they invented, but naturally was on the botte that is oval.
Oh, so is that why people might have done like grates on top?
See, see, okay. Yes.
As it opposed to steaks.
Exactly, but was adapting these. So my father, we went from the botti to the stainless steel. We never lived at that stage because my father was an enologist, technique, and he said, oh, he wanted to have the winery clean. He wanted maybe have the possibility to temperature control the wine because it was a big problem in the past. So stainless steel was perfect of this. But instead to buy cask of stainless steel, large and short, he bought... short and tall, with the hole in top very, very high, so he could submerge the cup. Let's say he tried to, he couldn't build a stainless steel cask in oval or round as a botti, because it was not possible. So the closest shape to that was like more a tube.
It's like a smokestack almost.
Si, 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 si. And when you submerge the cup, it's like a French press coffee. You know,
yeah, sure.
Like
you still do that?
Absolutely. It's our base of our all the crew. invented this kind of stainless steel screen to put inside to push down the cap in the cask for the Cappello Sommerso, for the submerged cap. Then after the Tine, that was an experiment that my father did with a French winery, but also with Diamond Creek, Al Brunstein, that was dear friends of him. They created this idea of doing the piston to do plunging down.
Did you ever meet Al?
Si, si, si.
Yeah, what was he like?
Era squisito. And my father loved him. And the crazy story, they both they died of Parkinson. They were incredible. So after that, they said, okay, let's try to do the Tine, because there are many people that were doing this tonneau, no, big tonneau. I think it's, Tine is correct, tonneau in English, like to ferment, like the Bordeaux style.
Yeah, open top.
Open top, fermenter, large. And so he, instead to do the plunging down, invented this system, this piston, this pneumatic piston. We did. It was the first period that also I was in the helping him in the winery. I was finished the enological school.
Oh, what was that? Like the 80s? Late 80s?
87. Was it 86, 87, if I remember well.
You decided you wanted to do wine.
See, I think we are genetically modifying my family to make wine after many generations.
Did you consider doing something else for a while?
I think if I know, was not making wine, I was probably, my dream of kids was to be a ranger at National Park.
Yeah, I was going to say,
with a big hat, like this, chasing the horse, the bear, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely.
But I was going to say like a hang glider or something, like a guy who does like some kind of outdoor sports.
Si, you know, but my sister, this is funny because I always live in the country, in the bicycle around, in the vineyard, hunting with a wild boar, a farmer kid, so, you know. My sister, the older sister, she was living in Torino, doing the university. And so sometimes I was going there to see her, you know, to meet her. And I remember that Torino was a big city, you know, houses and no garden, no nothing. I was staying in the house. At the time, there was no PSP, you know, television or anything, you know. And so one time a day, my sister was like, instead of going around to walk the dog, was walking me in the park. And I was running like the dog because I need this open space. So I always love the open space. And this is the reason why the best part of my business is I love the vineyard. I love to be in the vineyard, to be with the vine is the best part.
But why did you decide to go to wine school? I mean, what was the decision?
I always helped my father since I was a kid. You know, when I was 16, 17, probably I was also going with the motorcycle away to chasing some girl. I was escaping, you know. There was the other day, Ed McCarthy, the writer.
Yeah, sure. So
very funny.
He chases the girls a lot.
Ah, absolutely. No, but not for this. No. No, Mary, no. She's going to kill us. No. He one day he said to me, Luca, I still remember one time that I had a Vespa motorcycle, you know. And he said, I remember when your father was screaming, looking for you to go to come in the vineyard, in the winery to work. And I heard the motorcycle going away. And he said, now you are here making the wine. I was natural. It was a natural thing, you know, for me. I liked it. I loved it. But I was much more interested in the less in the chemistry. For sure, it's very important to know the reason why things happen and the reason why you don't want that shit happens sometimes. I was always very interested, you know, in the wine, the profile, the testing wine from different regions. I think I had so many good friends that I had the possibility to taste with them, so generous that they taste incredible wine from all around the world. And I think if you want to try to make a good wine, you need to add and drink a good wine before. Because, you know, you cannot just drink Barolo, but you have to drink good wine from all around the world because quality is more large than your home.
That's probably a change with your generation, right? I mean, that's probably...
See, I think that was the generation, the generation also of, people like Saltare, Scavino, Sandrone, all these people, Domenico Clerico, they were probably the first generation that they really loved to drink other wine, because it was very unusual as a person of the generation before, as my father, that they were drinking not Barolo, or they were drinking Burgundy or Bordeaux or Riesling or other wine. Very few people they did. I worked a little bit in France, in Burgundy, in Bordeaux, in a beautiful property. I worked in California. And then at a certain point, my father said, no, come home. It's time to real work. And I was helping him, and but he gave me, he said, I remember from my life, okay, let's start to ruin your first wine, make the Barbera. And I did, and I really wanted to prove, because you feel a lot of responsibility. Feeling today a responsibility of all this generation on my shoulder. And so I did for Barbera. So many, see, all what I know, all the experience that I took around the world, all what I learned on the book, all what the history of the region was trying to make the best of Barbera as possible. And I think probably it was also the period where Giacomo Bologna in Asti was making the Brico dell'Uccellone.
Sure, late 80s.
So Barbera at the time was a good wine, but was not the top wine as it was in the 1800s. Why? Because already the best vineyard, they were used, the best exposure, at least, they were used to make Barolo. Today, not even the best, the secondary exposure are for Barbera. Today, since the price of the land is so crazy in Barolo, Barbera vineyards are, if you are lucky, outside of the Barolo region, or really terrible exposure many times. Anyway, I did a lot of think and many experiments. I think one of the first experiments that I did was aging on the lees, the wine with Randall Graham. There was a crazy Randall that many times we talk, about the aging on the lees. I think I remember one time he was so amazing person, so funny. Unfortunately, the last years we don't see each other too much, but it was unbelievable. Many years he was knocking, arriving without notice, knocking the door, and I'm here. Oh, can I stay a few days here? Oh, porca miseria. So one time we were discussing, how the effect of the lees they were doing to the wine, because I was fascinated about the champagne, why the lees in the bottle, they keep so fresh the wine in the bottle, the late release. And so I remember one time, and I was doing stirring lees on the red wine, that was very unusual, keeping the contact on the lees for months. And one time he said, we need to do in the body, we need to do the bed for the lees. We need to create some... floor, like an elevator in the cask. I said, Minchia Randall, you are really even more visionary than me. And is it really more visionary?
Did you know other people doing long lees contacts? I've heard that sometimes for Giacosa, long lees contact on reds.
No. Questo, beh, Giacosa was always very reserved person. So I didn't heard at least from him. I'm sure maybe he was doing. I experimented after. I was getting interested after a trip that I did in Champagne, and I went to the cellar. It was again with Ed McCarthy and Mary Mulligan. They took me because it was the only chance to go with a writer to go to this great house. And we are down in the one time we are in the cellar of Bollinger, and there was Monsieur Montgolfier. Monsieur Montgolfier was incredible. The story. He was his great grandfather was the inventor of the balloon. I think so.
I didn't know that.
He told me he was. They had paper. A very famous house of Montgolfier, something like with the balloon in top. Anyway, and we are in the cellar. We open in the courtyard. Open the door. We go downstairs. I was young winemaker and I didn't know anything. I know that. Champagne at the bubble, that's all. So I go in the cellar and he was talking about RD wine And there was this pile of bottle. I think it was something that was the early 90s when I was there. And I think it was something from 70, because at the time RD was more than 10 years, I think so, if I remember well.
Bollinger RD.
Bollinger RD.
Yes. The late release on the lees.
Exactly, where they keep on the lees for a long, long time, and then they do late the gorgement. And he said to, these with 10 years, let's say, 10 years on the lees. And I said, interesting. But how a white wine can age so long, you know? And he looked at me and said, young Italian, you don't trust me. You know, I know that sometimes, you know, the bullshit. And I said, okay, Vicky, I remember there was my mother was with me. She wanted to kill me, you know, when I said that. So he took a dirty glass in the cellar that was there and he washed it on the hose. And he took one metal key and he took one bottle from that pile. And he sabered there,
yeah,
in the cellar. And he gave me a glass, say, taste it. Then you tell me what he looked like. Minchia, was fantastic. Was incredible. Was a fun. And really, I started turning my mind a light. I said, why? How is possible? And then I started with a million of questions to him. Why? Is the lees? What the lees do to the wine? How is possible that they can keep so fresh a white wine like this? Blah, blah. And then I went home and I experimented on the Barbera. And it was one funny.
What was the results of that?
It was very, very interesting because I think lees in the wine, and now I do in all the wine, we do also in the Nebbiolo, the long, long contact of the lees.
But it's different for each crew, right? Like the timing?
See. We, some of them, like Ravera, they stay 18 months on without racking, or Rocche sometimes 12 months. Depends. When is we do not have a timeline. When the wine needs to be racked, we rack. But some of them, they stay 2 years on the lees without racking from the Malolatti. I think lees, they released to the wine a lot of things. First of all, is a great regulator to the wine because they absorb as an sponge some defect of the wine. They keep the wine reduced, so protected by the oxygen. When in the skin of the yeast, there are some glucoside radicals, I don't know exactly, that they give to the wine body structure. Think about maybe a white wine barrel fermenter, a white wine stainless steel fermenter. If you separate the oak, the mouth feeling is different, you know? And then plus, I think they give a lot of things. An example, I am intolerant to the sulfur. I always made me headache. So the goal of my life, I was always trying to make wine with much less sulfur as possible.
You're saying you drink too much. That's what you're saying. You get too many headaches from the sulfur.
Absolutely. And then, let's say this is an excuse to say that I cannot drink cheap wine, you know?
You're right. I get the worst headache. Sorry.
Porca miseria. No, and so also they release a very strong radical antioxidize that are they help the wine to preserve.
So you're doing less sulfur additions because it was in reduction.
See, absolutely. I like to work in reduction. And more, I think the best result that I had in the recent wine was really working in reduction, keeping the wine stinky after the malolactic, the CO2 of the malolactic, and as long as possible. So the wine goes from onion, salami skin, dirty socks, gorgonzola, all the terrible things that you can imagine. And then he start to open and open and open. But also there is a CO2, you know, that protect from the oxygen. And then after a little bit, the fruit becomes very crunchy, the tannin, fantastic. You know, think about when you go to taste the wine in Burgundy from the barrel. They always, when they sample, they always have this reductive thing. And this Pinot Noir is, in one way, has many, some similarity to the Nebbiolo, you know. So are some more delicate wine that they need a little bit more reduction.
And that was a real difference, right, between the Rivera that you made in 2000 and then the Rivera that you made in 2010, because you took a 10-year break there, and then you changed up what you were doing, and it had to do with reduction, right?
See, because I'm not a good winemaker, so it took me 10 years to figure out what to do with that vineyard. No, this was one of the errors that I did in... I do error every day. Every day I do error, and but you know, you learn from the error that you do and you try to do better. But it was... that time we recently bought Vigna Ravera. Ravera we bought in 94, if I remember well, 95. In Novello, but Ravera is very, very large appellation. It's next to Cogno. It's this beautiful... Ravera has one side that in Barolo that face one direction and the other side that face completely the other direction. And we bought for the incredible price of 50 milioni di lire alla acres. That means 25,000 euro an acres in 94. And if you think that today the price of the vineyard is something as more than 1 million of euro for 1 acre, I think that it was a good investment. These are 5 acres, there are something, sono 2.5 ettari, quindi probably more. And then we said in the family, why we do not make a little bit more modern interpretation, you know, because was this moment, as I said before. And we did, you know, we made a little bit shorter fermentation, more French oak, and the wine that came
more
out...
More modern style.
Modern style. Yeah. And the wine that came out was not really shitty wine. It was good wine.
This is the 2000
vintage. 99 and 2000. 2000 actually got from a very important magazine, very, very, very high score. So it was 98. And really, it was good. I still drink it today. It's very, very good. For me, I never felt comfortable. For me, it was like, I always say this stupid analogy that, you know, when you see in the store these beautiful shoes, handmade, shining, leather, very fancy, and then you say, porca miseria, cazzo, I wanted to have, you know, and then you buy, very expensive maybe, and then you put in your shoes and you say, oh my God, they hurt you. And you don't feel comfortable. You know, don't feel your shoes, you know. I like it to have shoes. My shoes, I throw away when they have the holes because for me, it's a part of a life, you know, the shoes. So I never felt comfortable. So in 2001, I said to the family, no more Ravera. And everybody was mad with me, all the importer, distributor, they said, you're stupid, you know, everybody wants to have the Ravera. Why you stop? You know, I didn't like them. I didn't feel, no, like them. I didn't comfortable, you know? And so I stopped them, and I went to many series of experiments. So I went completely the opposite side.
More traditional,
long maceration, long skin contact with maceration, and then I started to do some experiment with the lees that I was doing to do malolactic in large cask, doing the malolactic when the malolactic won't happen.
So that sounds a lot like you were trying to get something more than fruit.
See, you know, it was because one of this later, but I think one of the. Was like my grandfather was already doing like this. My father was saying that the old way was like this. So I said, let's try to do this.
On the lees, historically.
On the lees. No, the thing is this, because they were put in cask. And then the wine, they were working in the vineyard. They didn't have time to spend, to do a lot of racking. Then another funny story that I understood, that was when I worked in Bordeaux, I was working in Mouton Rothschild. As interns, I worked for 1 year there. The best barrel, the barrel that they used to give the sample, because...
when the critics and the journalists came by, yeah,
was
sure.
Like this, they were the barrel that they collected the lees. Because probably, you know, like I said, these lees, they had to do more racking at the end, and then these lees they release to the wine was more immediate, you know, more probably, more... more ready, you know, they were giving
more complexity.
More complexity. And so this thing, other thing, then I started to keep the wine on the malolactic for 6 months after. Then, you know, the wine start to stink. Sorry for the expression. I say, when it is a Grand Cru vineyard, so you start to shit in your pants, you are afraid to ruin the vineyard, so you rack the wine. Then, you know, friends also in Burgundy, they tell me, no, Luca, what? No, you need to keep the wine there. You need. So the next year I did 8 months. The year after I did 12 months, 14 months, 18 months. So, you know, and you see this great evolution. And one of the wines that inspired me was a Barolo that dear friends gave me. We taste together this bottle. Was the 1970 Mont Privato. That I asked Mauro Mascara, then I heard that it was 100% of Cao Mauricio, that one.
That was basically the first Cao Mauricio.
Sí, the pre- all, sí, yeah. Sí, I think. Sí,
he didn't label it that way, but it was.
Io label Mon Privato. And I think if you can find it in the market, you must buy, because that wine is crazy. 70 was good vintages, was not great vintages. Man, when I tried it, was fantastic, incredible. And so I asked Mauro Mascarello, and then I researched what he was doing. He was doing like this, you know, he's traditionally keep the wine in cask for a long time on the lees. So I said, okay, maybe I'm the direction that I took is not wrong. Yeah. Anyway, in the wine industry, nothing has to be invented. Everything is already invented. Maybe today we know the reason why shit happens in the past, and we can prevent, but everything is already invented. What you can invent? There is the experience, you know. Maybe there are some techniques they get forgotten for some year, then they bring back, they come back. So many wine now I work in a reduction. So it took me 10 years, and the next release was the 2010. 2000 and 2010.
Of the Ravera. And how is that aging? What are you...
I think he's aging beautiful. He's very severe wine. Because also, if you taste an example, the 2012, that is a vintage, I do not have obligation of marketing bullshit, but it's a vintage that personally I like a lot. Because I think he's going the same track as 08, 010. This more Burgundian style, more elegant, finesse. But of all the crew that we have, the 12 is the more monolithic in this moment. You know, it takes time. But it's not monolithic in terms of harsh tannin, green tannin. It's just square. He has what I like very much, and I was tasting the other day, is that when you taste it, it leaves in your mouth, in your tongue, a little bit of a sensation of this dark chocolate. You know, I love the bitterness, but not the bitterness of the green tannin. When I press the cask during the fermentation, when I decide to finish the maceration, the tannin, they go up, become green and green and green and green. Then they start to polymerize and get together. At a certain point, we don't know when, we don't know why, they get together and they become more round, more softer. And then at a certain point, they become more as a chestnut. Like the chestnut fruit, you know, the one under the sugar, the candy of chestnut. And then they arrive until to have a little bit more this dark, not very dry, not very bitter, but dark chocolate sensation. And it means that the tannin are fantastically very ripe, you know. I think this happens more for during the fermentation. And then after, because the influence on the lees on the tannin, I think we know probably the 20-30% of the benefit today of the lees in the wine. Probably next generation, they will know why Ravera was doing well or why, you know, more. See, absolutely. And very ripe, good ripe tannin. For me, is like a big muffin, a big panettone. Panettone, yeah, is like a big muffin with a lot of tannin. The top is like a lot of tannin, but very round. And this, for me, is a signature of for long aging.
Because sometimes when I taste the Vietti, I'm more thinking about Barolo, but, you know, a Nebbiolo from Vietti, sometimes I get a country bread, like a taste of bread, a hint of this.
See, probably this is a sum of the fact of the lees period that they stay. Absolutely, because, you know, it's a lees. If they stay in the wine, something they leave to the wine.
So do you think that when you have a wine like that, when you have that as a style of production, that it's helpful to decant the wine?
In terms of decanting the wine like this, I went into a different stages in Barolo. Honestly, I think young Barolo, you should decant and you should give a lot of air. Probably the middle stage of Barolo, doesn't need. Then the old Barolo, many times we think that the old wine, and absolutely all the old wine of the world, do not like a lot of air. And we are talking about 50, 60. Barolo, probably different than many other wines when it's very, very old, has some component that they oxidize, and it's like una coperta, like one blanket that it cover the beautiness of the wine. So if you leave in the glass, or you decant without shaking, you know, the wine, but decanting, and so this more volatile blanket goes away, the wine become back to life, or give some very good sink that this blanket was covering. So I think, see, honestly, then one thing, in the last few years, I always, first of all, try not to have a style. For me, having a winery style is something that I do not like, because I try to see vineyard. I love terroir. For me, it will be too arrogant to have a style, you know. So Rocche, I try to do in more some way. Brunate, I think through the history and experience that we have, we do maybe differently.
Well, they taste different.
Certo. In the last few years, the last 10 years, when you become more mature, I think this is part of the life of everybody. When you are younger, you wanted to prove. You wanted to show the world that you are able to take the heritage of a very important family. And so you want to show, you know, you show the big muscles. Then you arrive at a certain point that you... No, I don't want it to be feel as arrogant, but not absolutely not on the arrogant side. But you arrive at a point and say, cazzo, yes, something of good I did. So really, I do not have to prove that anything, because anyway, I need to prove that my terroir is good, not that I am a good winemaker. And then you arrive at a certain point that you have a different vision, because you start to think to say, well, I wanted to really now prove the future generation and the generation after my nephew, probably, that I was a good winemaker. So I wanted to make wine that live as long as possible. And here really is the, like a Barolo. Barolo is wine made for long aging. So I really, honestly, zero interest on immediate consumption in Barolo. And I don't care. For me, if people, they do not like a young Barolo, you know, don't drink a young traditional Barolo. It will be too bad to drink a young Barolo. And for me, is when you arrive to close to certain age, you try to live to survive. And so we will die one day or the other, I hope in other 100 years. But we hope that part of us will survive longer than us and will be the wine.
So you actually make several Barbera. You make the Scaroni. You make the Vigna Vecchia Scaroni, which you already explained was planted by your family before you got there. Then you replanted Nebbiolo to Barbera and Scaroni. And then you make a La Crena.
La Crena, yes.
Which is a different Barbera.
Si, is from Asti. That is because one of the stupid thing that I did, it was not stupid, but the thing that you do when you are young, brave, and a little bit stupid, but I wanted to prove my family that I was able to make the best Barbera as possible. We basically replant a vineyard of Barolo next to the Vigna Vecchia of Barbera, because I asked it to my father to have more land available for Barbera. And then...
Because he only let you make Barbera. And you wanted to make more of it.
See, no, with the experience of Vigna Vecchia, I said, Vecchia, this is fucking good Barbera. We need... He's like a chef. You know, a great chef can make a great meal with the ingredients, with the best ingredients. My ingredients are the vineyard. I cannot make a good Barbera from a secondary vineyard, you know, from a shitty vineyard. You will always make a second wine. So I said, why we do not plant more Barbera there, where is the Barolo vineyard? And my friend, no, it's not possible. We already have Vigna Vecchia, keep that. And then I tried at a certain point, my father said, okay, let's, I'm sure that he probably knows that what I wanted to do. Because I never asked them, but probably is one thing that I would like to ask them. I wanted to ask, I never asked. And he said, okay, there is this old vineyard of Barolo with not appropriated clones. And he said, replant this vineyard with appropriate clones of Nebbiolo for Barolo. I ordered by error Barbera. At the time, there were no email. They were fax.
You did it on purpose or you made a mistake?
No, I did it on purpose. I did it. Because I wanted to... I said, Cazzo, if I am able to... You don't recognize immediately that it's Barbera because first leaves, you don't see, it takes 1 year, 1 year and a half. I said, maybe we are closer to the
you second
thought
he year. Wouldn't notice?
And we don't notice. I will be able to make the first vinification and there will be a good wine. So maybe I will be rescued. But cazzo, that was a big piece of Barolo vineyard that I replanted as Barbera. And... I planted it. Then when, after 1 year and a half, too early, unfortunately, some neighbor farmer there, and they asked my father, they said, hey, well, you know that you have some Barbera planted in the Grand Cru Barolo there in the Scarone. And my father went there and he started to say all the bad words that he knows. Ah! Then he called the nursery and he said, well, what the fuck you gave me the Barbera vines instead of Nebbiolo. And the nursery guy said, no, well, your son ordered. I have here the fax, the confirmation fax, you know. Porca miseria. It was huge trouble. Huge trouble.
What happened there?
It happened that, that my father was very intelligent. He understood that I did this for quality, not to make the stupid thing.
And you, I think you liked the Vignivecchia and you thought you could make more.
Yes.
Like
and I think he had to show to me that he was mad with me. But I think in his heart, he was happy because I think he probably said, okay, this guy got it. You know, the quality, the idea of doing great wine. And thanks God, I have to say, the first Barbera that they came out from this vineyard, they were very, very well received. I have to thank Matt Kramer that he did incredible review on the Barbera. Robert Parker, 2 years ago, he remembered me that the first Barbera that he tried, he loved that Barbera. It was very important for small kids, you know, to have so big welcome, you know, from very important.
And for this reason, you're still alive.
And for this reason, I'm still alive.
Could have gone bad.
Minchia. Really, absolutely. No.
And McCarthy's at the cellar saying, whatever happened to Luca? I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, he's gone.
Please. No, there was an incredible thing. And unfortunately, today there are not too many good Barbera. I'm a little bit afraid for the Barbera because he had a moment that he had a new life because many more people they were planting in the Barolo region, Barbera. And then today is much, much less. Many wineries are really taking again, giving place to more Nebbiolo. Why? Because the land is so expensive. You know, also if you buy 1 acre of land for 1.5 million of euro, you are not going to plant Barbera, you plant Nebbiolo, you know. And so this is the reason why also we went in Asti region of Lacrena, because Asti is a there are part of Asti that production of Barbera in Asti is huge.
They can't make Barolo there.
No. For this reason, the most important spot, the best position, best vineyard used for Barbera. And we were looking for long time at property, but we never found anything good. Then one day, one mediatore, dealer of land, that he took us around one time and he showed many pieces, you know. And I asked him, show us the best exposure. And he showed us many positions. And one of these was in Agliano. It was a vineyard owned by a winery called Trinchero.
Oh, yeah, sure. In Asti, yeah.
And he had these 8 hectares. And that Affa was planted in 1932. And where from this vineyard, this guy was also a consultant, was his wine consultant. He said, you know, from this vineyard, very old vine, Trinquero make Viña del Noce, that in the 80s was probably one of the most important Barbera, and still today, very, very good, the name. And so, cazzo, I wanted that piece of land. He said, no, he's owned by this winery, so it's impossible to buy. And then one day, he called me and he said, look, you know, I need to come tomorrow because maybe there is a good surprise. So we go to the house of this Trinquero, and he had a son and a daughter. And I think the daughter married the son of Guido from the restaurant.
Da Guido.
Si, si.
Yeah, that's a good restaurant. Probably eats well.
Si. And the son wanted to continue the winery. And so probably the good father said, okay, I wanted to give some money to the daughter and keep the winery and vineyard for the son. And so he decided to sell the property not next to the winery. And that was the most fastest purchase that I did in my life because we went there and we sit on this long table. At the end of the table, there is this Trinquero man, old farmer, and fantastic person. And he said to me, okay, you are, say, what you want to do? I said, we would like to, I know that this vineyard is for sale. And he said, okay, but my land is expensive. I said, okay, he's... So, and he said the price. The price was much cheaper than any Barbera, or can imagine. You know, was very cheap coming from Barolo region. And he expected probably that we were make a, come say, deal, you know?
Yeah, argue down. Argue negotiate, down, you know? Yeah.
And then he said, okay. And I opened the check and I brought the check and I gave to him. And he looked at the check. And we bought him. A few years later, I saw him, like a, was older man, and he was big room during the tasting. And he said to me, oh, Luca, vaffanculo. So I say in Italian, don't translate. Vaffanculo. You know, I had to ask you more money for that vineyard. He said, oh, sorry. Pardon. But for me, it was fantastic because it was half of that vineyard planted in 1932. 1935. So immediately you could make a fantastic wine. And La Crena still today made from this very old vine. And another piece to be planted, so we could plant our Massal selection from Vigna Vecchia, clones that we did. And there was another piece planted in 71. So let's say it was fantastic because we could make a Trevigne Barbera from the three location, the three age, and the crew from the old vine. And I still think that La Crena, for me, is one of our more under the radar wine that I make because I love La Crena. And it's a wine that ages extraordinary, you know, very well. I think I always open a bottle of the 90s. For my guests in the cellar to show how is it because also in the old time the Barbera was wine made for aging, you know, for if you have the baby born in the family, the farmer, they were selling the Barolo and they were putting aside of the vintage of the kids some good Barbera as the style of Scarone and La Crena.
What's the difference between handling Barbera and handling Nebbiolo? What have you learned over the years?
In the vineyard, the main difference is this, that first of all, I think a Barbera like when the vintage is a little bit more warmer than Nebbiolo. Nebbiolo likes more fresh. But Nebbiolo, as the Pinot Noir, doesn't like very much the heat. Not talking about the heat, but a little bit more warmer vintage. Also because berries of a Barbera are... big cluster, the Barbera, you know. So you have to do a lot of green harvest. And then if it's humid, the Barbera is very vigorous vine. There is one of more vigorous variety that we have. So they suck a lot of water from the soil, the berries, they become very big, diluted. So it's difficult to handle. You have to do green harvest 10 times and then you never enough. You have to do bleeding in the winery during the vinification. So Barolo Nebbiolo is different because it has the smaller berries, so it's not so vigorous variety. So really the work in the vineyard are very, 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 very different, you know, in from Barbera and Nebbiolo. An example, Nebbiolo, you want to leave long cane to the, you want it to have many solar panel leaves, you know, for your Nebbiolo. And also Nebbiolo need to have many, many shoots. Barbera, half we give, you leave less canes, you know, less shoot. With Nebbiolo, you want it to, when you prune, when you have the bourgeon in French, just, the gemme in Italiano, you want it to leave more. In the years ago, I used to make much more green harvest. Now I make, I do the green harvest in many more time. Instead of doing one time, I do sometimes three, four, five times because with the severe, strange weather that we have, you never know, because you can have a beautiful July and a hot August, or so-so July and very raining August. So you cannot see in July, imagine how the harvest is going to be. So you need to be very quiet, you know, you need to be very cautious to do everything. So, and then I leave a little bit more grape than what I was doing before, because some years ago I was even over a lower yield.
It was too low.
Too low. And then when it's too low, you cannot do anything when the grape arrive in the cellar. So I prefer to have a little bit more. And then when I crush the grape, I can decide immediately if I do some bleeding or not. So I can adjust in the cell. So you have anyway more skin for the juice that you have. And in Barbera, we do a lot of bleeding because big berries means a lot of water inside, less skin. We do a lot of rosé. We produce every year a lot of rosé.
I didn't know that.
Certo.
Does that ever leave the winery?
No, we sell by bulk to other winery, but it's good rosé. We sometimes we make for the one barrel for the family for the summertime, but it's not. We sell to other winery. And in terms of maceration, Barbera doesn't require long contact with the skin. Likes to do, as the Nebbiolo, even more than the Nebbiolo, cold stock maceration. So maceration at low temperature before to start the fermentation, but doesn't like to go long time on the skin, because every time that it stay on the skin a long time, it become a little bit more rustic, the Barbera, mainly in Asti. So let's say 15 days, not long. Then a Barbera is very difficult wine, because very difficult wine to make him dry, because many times you know, you have don't finish the fermentation, and it is much more easy to be attacked by Brettanomyces. Think that
because the acidity is lower, is that one?
I think really for the vegetation, because Brettanomyces, for me, they live in nature. For sure, the wine with lower acidity and high pH, you know, the Brettanomyces, they make a party. But I think, and I had an experience, that some vineyard of Barbera that I had, that I keep more, you know, we do not use herbicide or pesticide. So anyway, sometimes you have grass growing in the vineyard. So the part a little bit more humid, and so the vegetation is of Barbera is very opulent. From that vineyard, statistically, we have more problem of Brett from that vineyard, because probably Brett that they live in the vineyard, they like they are on the skin of the grape, because the yeast are on the skin of the grape. They like this vineyard more fresh, more rustic, more with great vegetation.
Huh.
So it's quite different, they think. Plus the aging. Probably Barbera is the one that needs in the youngest stage a little bit more oxygen, you know. So maybe some malolactic in small barrel, not new oak, but a small barrel to give more oxygen, they take a good benefit. And then the second part in the large cask of botti.
So if the skins are different for Barbera, does that mean it's more sensitive to rot?
Sì, porca miseria, because the Barbera is a variety that one day his grape is fantastic, the next day is botrytis. Because It's very strange. The skin of a Barbera degradates during the maturation of the grape very fast. You arrive in a moment where when you touch the grape with your finger, the skin goes away, you know? And so you need to be very careful during mainly the harvest that are very fresh or very humid, because it's easy to get botrytis. And also, let's say, if Nebbiolo, an example, you know, sometimes we got a hail. A vineyard of Nebbiolo, you can clean the berries, you can take away the bad berries and these, and sometimes you do not feel too much the hail. In Barbera, you can do whatever. And if you have the vineyard with mold and hail, you cannot do anything. It's better. I learned the lesson that I said, I spent too much time and too much nervoso. Made me mad many times that anyway, when I have vintages like these, you already know.
And what about the Perbacco Nebbiolo? I feel like that's gotten some acclaim.
That is something that exploded in our hands. It was a wine very... So, years ago, my family was able to collect really an incredible series of very good vineyards. You know, the vineyard that, you know, I hope very soon we will be able with the consortium to arrive at this classification of a vineyard, you know, to extract 20 Grand Cru, as really we need to do. Already many writers, they did their classification and it's the same. You know, we know Brunate, that is Brunate, Cannubi, that is good Cannubi, or Cerecchio, Rocche, and so on. We just need an official classification. And we have many of these. And my father was making, you know, one Riserva de Villero, not made every year. We only made in some specific vintages. Traditionally was making Rocche, Brunate, and Lazzarito. Then we had the Ravera. But then we had many other very good vineyards of Barolo. Bricco Boschis, Bricco del Fiasco, Vignard in Bussia, in Ginestra, in Le Coste Le Liste, Fossati, Bricco Viole, Rocchette Vino, so very important wine that are flagship wine for many winery. I forgot some for sure. In the past, my father, after making the Cru, he was blending all the other to make the Barolo Castiglione. Years ago, I said, how I can do better? How I can improve this? Because it was really difficult, because... For sure, Barolo and Barbaresco of my parents among Giacosa, Conterno, Rinaldi, Mascarello, they were already very important wine, very recognized, very good Barolo. And so I started to make the vinification of all these very important vineyards separately, aging separately. And in the bottom floor, my cellar, if you remember, where there are all these big botti, this large cask, Slavonia Nock, every cask is a different Grand Cru, Bussia, Sorigine, Bricco del Fiasco, Bricco Boschis, Rocchette Vino, and so on. After 3 years of aging, we select, instead to blend, like my father was doing blind tasting, we select of these 11 great personality vineyards, cask, the 5, the 6, the 4, depends from the year. Not necessarily the best one, the one that they get together better, the one that they feel comfortable together better. And we blend to make the Castiglione, because my idea was to try to make the Castiglione the highest level as possible, because today Cru Barolo are becoming crazy. There is a lot of speculation on Barolo as Burgundy, as not Corduron. Far East market is becoming crazy, you know. I estimate that 20% of my Barolo Cru that I ship in the state go back to Asia, because I always see my American label in the Asian market. You know, it's something that Burgundy producer, they already face since many years, and I think it will happen, if it's not just happening for Barolo. So I needed a very important Barolo Castiglione. And so I had the tools to do these many, many good players. Let's say I'm like a friend of mine said that I am like a coach that has a team of basketball that with 11 top, very famous, very good paid players. And for that game, you need to choose five to play, you know? And so this is the thing that I do. And my goal was to make the Castiglione the constancy year after year to elevate. And I arrived there. I think Castiglione did incredible jump in the quality in the last years. Then I had these four, five, six cask of Barolo left. And then for many years, we've been tempted. At the beginning, actually, I was tempted to say, okay, what I do? I make a regular Barolo or what we make? And then we decided in the family not to make a regular Barolo because we didn't want it to be confused as a commercial wine. You know, we try to be different. You know, in every business, there is something that you want to do and something that you don't want to do. You feel that you don't like to do. And so we decided to bottle as a Lange Nebbiolo, like the Rosso, different style than many Lange Nebbiolo, because many Lange Nebbiolo, unfortunately, are the Biolo vineyard planted outside of the Barolo region or young vine and blended with shitty Merlot, Cabernet, another thing. This is different. So I just blended after the bottling, like I did in 2013, 1 month ago. And instead to call Barolo, I call Lange Nebbiolo. And then I went the first time to my mother with a glass of this wine. And I said, oh, mama, let's try our first Lange Nebbiolo. And she thought that, you know, was a secondary vineyard. She was not aware there was a selection of cask at the third year of a good Barolo. And she, when she tasted it, she said, oh, Perbacco. Perbacco is very old Italian, gentle expression that means, wow, I would say, oh, porca miseria, or minchia, but I couldn't put minchia on the label, or porca miseria. So I said, okay, this is a great name to put on the bottle. And honestly, I didn't expect all these success on the Perbacco, because it really became, a great introduction to the people, for the people, for Barolo. Many, many, many sommeliers, they started to use as an introduction, you know, to the Barolo, because Barolo, as the Pinot Noir from Burgundy, are not easy wine. Many people, they pretend to know and to understand because Barolo is fancy, Pinot Noir is sexy, you know, but they are difficult wine, and wine that you need skill, you need training. And I think in every world, I think there are many Perbacco around the world. So wine that they can help the customer to grow in their appreciation and to understand without spending a fortune to a big commitment to understand what Barolo is. Then maybe in the future, if they like a Barolo, they will buy other wine. So it really became a wine that helped me. First of all, I have much more demand than our production. And, you know, we don't want to make more because then you have to start to compromise. And then I want to make some bottle of Barolo Castiglione, you know. Sometimes we need to pay our bill too. But he did incredible service for my family because, like I said before, many people, they know Vietti for the history, all the winery, good wine. But not everybody, they can afford a bottle of Rocche, Villero, Brunate, Lazzarito because are not, unfortunately, cheap wine. And so I think Perbacco was fantastic because really in a normal base, in regular base, let understand to the people how serious we work.
So how do you envision changes coming up in the future for your winery in the next 5 years, 10 years?
We try every year to buy a piece of land more to have maybe possible another crew, but it's very difficult because the price of the land are very expensive. I think in one way we are focusing even more on the Castiglione. I think Castiglione is a wine that I wanted to bring even to another step, maybe adding some very good crew there inside. Perbacco, I think in the last year we are experimenting some very good vineyards of Barbaresco, a very good crew, but I don't want to bottle until I'm sure they are fantastic. So I do all the best that I can. And then the third year I put on the Perbacco, and then we will see in 4, 5, 6, 7 years to do. So I think, yeah, a few bottles more of Perbacco, but coming from a Gran Cru Barbaresco. And then something different, something funny. I have some small experiment to do in the cellar of different wine that my father was making in the past. Then he stopped to make. This year we want to make a Freisa re-fermented in the bottle, like in the old my father was okay. making, and it was very fun. But three bottles, just for fun. And then I have a small experiment from an old variety in Piemonte that but I you should try before that I tell you, because then I don't want to make a mistake. It was a region that in the 1700 was larger planting there than Barolo region, and then he almost disappeared, and where the origin of Nebbiolo it was. And so we are doing some experiment to see if we are able to, but this is for fun, because I think you need to do something fun, you know. If not, it becomes boring, you know, too serious. You know, wine is a serious thing, but when you take out the cork, it's party. And also you have to take also the thing more easy, you know, more, because if you hold too much pressure on your shoulder, you know, you're going to explode, you know. And so I always felt in my life that I always had too much pressure in my shoulder for the history of the family and this and that. So I think in this moment I have the luxury to do some wine as I want, as the vineyard wants, without to prove anything to anybody. And so it's big relief for me. And this is, I think, I'm more happy now than what it was 10 years ago, that I was younger.
Luca Corrado sees himself as a coach of Barolo in pursuit of pleasure. Thank you very much for being here today.
Grazie mille. Thank you.
Luca Corrado Vietti of Vietti in Castiglione in the Barolo zone. Thank you.
Ciao, grazie.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Scala has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's ILLDrinktothatPOD.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.